Today is Wednesday, September 15th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, tension rises as North and South Korea test cruise missiles.
A sort of burgeoning arms race on the Korean Peninsula.
Plus, President Biden says extreme weather will cost the U.S. over $100 billion.
Hurricanes in the Gulf Coast and up this eastern seaboard. Wildfires threatening throughout the West and tearing it apart. Droughts and heat waves across the country, devastating farmers and ranchers. And
also, UN warns against reliance on artificial intelligence technology. Our top story today is around the Korea Peninsula. Rivals North and South Korea launched ballistic missiles hours apart from each other on Wednesday, in a display of weapons that came amid a faltering diplomatic push to end North Korea's nuclear weapons program. South Korea's presidential office says its military successfully tested its first underwater-launched ballistic missile on Wednesday afternoon. It said a missile fired from a 3,000-ton class submarine hit its designated target. This statement said the weapon is expected to help South Korea deter potential external threats, boost its self-defense posture, and promote peace on the Korean Peninsula. The test followed two short-range North Korean ballistic missile launches detected by South Korea's military early Wednesday. On Monday, North Korea said it fired a newly developed cruise missile in its first weapons test in 6 months. South Korea's military said the North Korean missile launched from Central Korea on Wednesday flew about 800 kilometers, that's 497 miles, to a height of 60 kilometers, before landing in the ocean between the Korean Peninsula and Japan. The U.S. Indo-Pacific Command said the launches, while heightening the destabilizing impact of North Korea's illicit weapons program, didn't pose any immediate threat to, quote, U.S. personnel or territory or to any of our allies, unquote. According to North Korean accounts, the missile demonstrated an ability to hit targets 1,500 kilometers away, which puts all of Japan and the U.S. military installations there within reach. For more on the growing tensions, I spoke with VOA Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo.
A sort of burgeoning arms race on the Korean Peninsula. This is nothing new, of course. North Korea has for a long time tested missiles, both long range and short range. For the last couple of years, it's been testing mainly short range ballistic missiles, I think out of concern that it doesn't want to provoke too much tension and risk maybe an overwhelming response by the U.S. that would make things harder for North Korea economically and related to diplomatic isolation. In South Korea, what you have actually is a left-leaning government, very much wants to prove that it can defend itself, even with without the help of the U.S. So what you've had is a lot of investment into military technology, specifically ballistic missile technology, that has resulted in several ballistic missile tests, including today the first ever launch by South Korea, an underwater launch of a submarine ballistic missile. This was actually tested from a submarine at sea, and they are now one of seven countries in the world to actually have this technology. So it seems that both sides are sort of arming up here on the Korean Peninsula, but it's certainly a concerning situation.
Is it a coincidence that South Korea launched or tested their ballistic missile just today, or are they sending a message to the North?
It's really hard to say why we saw a ballistic missile test on the same day. I've been talking to experts, and they really can't remember any other previous day where you've seen both sides conduct ballistic missile tests. And it's interesting, not just because both North and South Korea conducted ballistic missile tests on the same day. It's also interesting because South Korea was hosting the Chinese foreign ministry for talks, but you know, this is very sensitive. South Korea is an ally of the U.S. and relies on the U.S. for security, for protection, defense protection, but it relies on China for its economic well-being. And so this was a very interesting timed event. It also comes as U.S., Japanese, and South Korean envoys meet in Tokyo to discuss North Korea. It's really hard to say why exactly this all happened at the same time. It may have been a coincidence, but we really don't know.
The North Koreans claim that their ballistic missile can reach not just Japan, but U.S. facilities around the area. Any possibility that Washington might be drawn into this, especially since South Korea depends on the U.S. for security?
What we had over the weekend was a North Korean cruise missile test, which I think was a serious threat to South Korea and Japan, as well as U.S. forces in the region. But that activity is not actually banned by United Nations Security Council resolutions. Those resolutions mention ballistic missile activity. And so today what we saw by North Korea was a ballistic missile test. And it is prohibited under United Nations Security Council resolutions from any ballistic missile activity. Therefore, I think the U.S. will make some statement, whether that's a condemnation, simply a condemnation, or whether they go further and try to push for an expansion of sanctions at the Security Council. I do think we'll see a response from the United States.
That's VOA South Korea Bureau Chief Bill Gallo speaking with me from Seoul. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's influential sister accused the South President Moon Jae-in of, quote, slander, unquote, Wednesday, after both Koreas carried out missile launches, according to the North state media. Moon described the North's action as, quote, provocations, unquote, prompting Kim Yong-jan, a key advisor to her brother, to condemn Seoul's, quote, illogical attitude that describes their similar behavior as a legitimate action to support peace and ours as a threat to peace, unquote. U.S. General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is said to have secretly called his Chinese counterpart twice over concerns then-President Donald Trump could spark a war with China as his potential election loss loomed, the Washington Post reported on Tuesday. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
The top U.S. general secretly called his Chinese counterpart twice during the presidency of Donald Trump. That's according to a Washington Post report on Tuesday. U.S. General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, called General Li Zhuchang of the People's Liberation Army on October 30th last year and again on January 8th, 2 days after the storming of the U.S. Capitol, over concerns that then-President Donald Trump could spark a war with China, the newspaper reported. The report draws on reporting from a new book, Peril, based on interviews with over 200 sources. It is due to be released next week. Trump, in a statement, cast doubt on the story, calling it fabricated. He said if the story was true, Milley would be tried for treason. Milley's office declined to comment. Republican Senator Marco Rubio called on President Joe Biden, a Democrat, to immediately fire Milley. The White House has declined to comment on the report. The Washington Post reported that Milley was motivated to contact Beijing the second time, in part due to a call with U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who had asked the general what safeguards were in place to prevent a, quote, unstable president from launching a nuclear strike.
That's Libby Hogan of Reuters. Extreme weather events will cost the United States well over $100 billion this year, topping last year's cost of $99 billion, U.S. President Joe Biden said on Tuesday. Biden, speaking at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado, said nearly one in three American communities had been struck in the past few months by weather disasters exacerbated by climate change. Biden hopes to tap into voters' concerns about the climate to gain popular support for a $3.5 trillion spending plan that is being negotiated in the U.S. Congress. Republicans are adamantly opposed to the legislation, in part because it will raise taxes on the wealthy.
Communities that nearly one in three Americans call home have been struck by weather disasters in just the past few months. Hurricanes in the Gulf Coast are up this eastern seaboard. Wildfires threatening throughout the West and tearing it apart. Droughts and heat waves across the country, devastating farmers and ranchers and draining the Colorado River. In addition to the lost lives shattered, extreme weather cost America last year $99 billion. And it's going to break the record this year. It's going to be well over $100 billion. We know what the driver is, climate change. We know what's causing climate change, human activity. This is no longer subject to debate. And I might add, windmills do not cause cancer. You know, look, we got to get real about what's going on. I really mean it. Think about it. The only debate is around what we do to confront this crisis. And that shouldn't even be a debate. Here's the good news. Something that is caused by humans can be solved by humans.
That's U.S. President Joe Biden. Turkey is calling for collective international action to deal with the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. The call comes as Turkey, already hosting the largest number of refugees globally, warns it cannot take any more. For VOA, Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu, addressing a high-level United Nations meeting on Afghanistan Monday, warned that with millions of Afghans displaced and facing a humanitarian crisis, now is the time for collective action.
A humanitarian and security crisis in Afghanistan will have direct implications across the globe. So we should take the collective action now.
Turkish leaders fear an Afghan exodus through its territory as refugees flee Afghanistan and head for Europe. Last week, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, paid a four-day visit to Turkey and praised the country for receiving nearly 4 million refugees who fled the Syrian civil war. Under a deal with the European Union, Turkey gets billions of dollars in aid to host the Syrians. Some EU leaders are already suggesting the agreement be extended to include Afghans, claiming refugees should be hosted in locations closest to their places of origin. But Turkey's main opposition, CHP party, is strongly critical of the government's refugee policy. Ünal Çeviköz is a CHP parliamentary deputy.
It is a record of serious mismanagement. It was simply a kind of transactional type of relationship between Turkey and the European Union. And they simply wanted to stop the flow of refugees by giving some financial assistance to Turkey. A majority of the Turkish population think that burden sharing is not fairly distributed in the international community. And we are also scared that the same mismanagement will continue in the case of Afghanistan.
Senior EU officials visited Ankara last week to talk about the refugee deal with Turkey. Ankara insists it cannot take any more refugees and calls for the EU to share the burden. Some analysts say Ankara needs the money from Europe, but international relations expert Soli Özel says Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan will need more than monetary incentives to convince his people.
He will have to show to the country something more than just money, and that's visa liberalization, which I doubt the Europeans are capable of delivering on.
Visa-free travel for Turks in the European Union was part of the original Syrian refugee deal, but until now has been blocked by some EU members. With Erdogan's ratings languishing at record lows in opinion polls, and the same polls indicating strong public opposition to receiving Afghan refugees, analysts predict any new EU refugee deal with Turkey will be difficult and fraught with political risk for the Turkish leader. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry on Tuesday replaced the chief public prosecutor who had been seeking charges against him as a suspect in the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse, plunging the country into a fresh political crisis. Again, Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry fired a prosecutor who has been seeking charges against him on Tuesday. The charges link Henry with the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse, who was shot dead in July. Chief Public Prosecutor Bedford Claude said last week that phone records showed Henry had twice communicated with a man believed to be the mastermind behind Moïse's killing on the night of the crime. That suspect, who is a former Justice Ministry official, is now on the run, and Henry has defended him. The prosecutor wrote to the judge overseeing the investigation into Moïse's killing on Tuesday and asked him to charge Henry as a suspect. Later in the day, a letter from Henry emerged, firing the prosecutor for, quote, a grave administration error, with no further detail. It remains unclear if that order is valid. Henry, a neurosurgeon and moderate, was named Prime Minister by Moïse just days before he was assassinated in an attempt to reduce political tension. Henry has tried to forge a new consensus between different political factions. Haiti has seen decades of political instability and natural disasters and is the poorest economy in the Americas. Moïse's death has led to deeper political turmoil, and questions around Henry's possible involvement may overshadow any consensus after the assassination.
That's Lily Hogan of Reuters. The World Health Organization said there were about 4 million coronavirus cases reported globally last week, marking the first major drop in new infections in more than 2 months. In recent weeks, there have been about 4.4 million new COVID cases. John Kengasong, director of Africa's Center for Disease Control, said on Tuesday that less than 3.5% of Africans are vaccinated against COVID-19, far short of the official target of 60%. World Health Organization head Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said at the same briefing that the continent was being, quote, left behind by the rest of the world, unquote, and that this would allow the coronavirus to keep circulating. African Union Special Envoy Strive Masiwa called on IMF and the World Bank to put a mechanism in place allowing poorer countries to access vaccines.
As a continent, we had endorsed a target of immunizing up to 60% of our population. I think a good starting place for all of us would be to understand where we are. As we speak today, as a continent of 1.3 billion people, we have just under 3.5% of our population, eligible population, that has been fully vaccinated.
That's John Kengasong, director of Africa's Center for Disease Control. This is the Voice of America. Algerian authorities arrested a prominent journalist and a Berber linguist this week as part of what appears to be a growing crackdown on dissent in the Kabyle region. Both are accused of belonging to the Kabyle Autonomy Movement, a group supporting the Kabyle minority that the Algerian government considers a terrorist organization. The group denies the accusation. The two arrested are among dozens of people detained in recent weeks. U.S. Human Rights Chief is calling for a moratorium on the use of artificial intelligence technology that could pose a serious risk to human rights, including face scanning systems that track people in public spaces. Michelle Bachelet also said countries should expressly ban AI applications that don't comply with international human rights law. Applications that should be prohibited include government, quote, social scoring, unquote, systems, which judge people based on their behavior, and certain AI-based tools that categorize people by ethnicity or gender. You are listening to International Edition of the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. International aid groups are calling on Burkina Faso's government to let them help register the country's internally displaced people. The Norwegian Refugee Council says the government is taking weeks to register IDPs for food and other aid, forcing some back into dangerous areas. Harry Wickens reports from Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso.
In a statement released Monday, the Norwegian Refugee Council, NRC, said government authorities are taking weeks to register IDPs, like these 500 or so, who until recently stayed at a school in the town of Ouagadougou. The NRC say they could carry out the registration process, which is essential before aid can be distributed to IDPs within a week, and implored the government to, quote, let us step in and support. Rasmata Ouedraogo, who was living in the school, fled her village of Nongo with her son after a terrorist attack. She says they were wearing army uniforms, so it was difficult to know if they were terrorists. She had to hide herself for 2 days in her house. She says she arrived in Ouagadougou around 2 months ago, and so far her family has received $100 in aid payments. The first thing we need is food for us and our children, and then some clothes, among other things, she told VOA. The community leader of the IDP says this month students will return to their studies, so the school's owner has asked the IDPs to move out. Local authorities sent them to a site outside of the town where access to food and services is difficult. At the very beginning, we were able to have some cereal like maize and millet, plus $100 for each family. But that was 2 to 3 months ago, he says. He added that some people arrived more recently, and those people have not gotten any food so far. Many of the IDPs who stayed at the school say they are unsure of whether they've been registered or not, but say none of them are receiving enough aid. Tom Peyre-Costa is from the Norwegian Refugee Council.
But authorities really lack the capacity to count and register newly displaced people. And meanwhile, aid organizations are not allowed to intervene. So this is what we are asking for today. We need more flexibility.
In a tense press conference Monday, Lawrence Marshall Ilbudo, the Minister of Humanitarian Affairs, said this when asked why offers of assistance from aid groups were being turned down. You asked why we don't make it easier for the partners if they can do it better than the locals. But why them? because they have the resources, because they have the machines. Our nation has the expertise to do it. Why don't we make use of this material expertise so that the locals can do it themselves? As the school now lies empty, waiting for the students to return, the IDPs who resided there remain in need of help. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Wagyu, Burkina Faso.
In a message of inclusion, Pope Francis is reaching out to the Roma people of Slovakia, where he had condemned Central Europe's historic marginalization of communities, including the Roma and the Jews. For VOA, Sabina Castelfranco reports from Rome.
On his second day in Slovakia, the Pope traveled to the town of Prešov in the eastern part of the country, where he celebrated Mass in the Byzantine Rite in the city's sports stadium. The highlight of the day was a visit to the Roma community in the nearby town of Košice, a gesture analysts see as a sign of inclusion. The impoverished Lunik neighborhood, which the Pope will visit, is home to the country's highest community of Roma residents, where his message is welcomed by a population living with problems that include overcrowded housing, in some cases with no running water or electricity. Slovakia has a 400,000-strong Roma minority, which has historically faced discrimination. On Monday, the Pope addressed the Slovak president and other officials in the gardens of Bratislava's presidential palace and stressed the need to work for the common good and not focus on individual needs. Referring to the nation's communist past, the Pope said that until a few decades ago, a single thought system stifled freedom, adding that today another such system is emptying freedom of meaning, reducing progress to profit and rights only to individual means. Pope Francis said fraternity is necessary for the increasingly pressing process of integration. The Pope also addressed representatives of the Jewish community on Monday at a memorial for Jews that were killed in the Holocaust. At this site, a synagogue was demolished in 1969 in what the Pope said were efforts to cancel every trace of the Jewish community. Here in this place, the Pope said, the name of God was dishonored, for the worst form of blasphemy is to exploit it for our purposes, refusing to respect and love others. More than 100,000 Slovak Jews were killed during the Holocaust, and the Pope added that it was shameful how people who said they believed in God perpetrated or allowed unspeakable acts of inhumanity. The Jewish community in Slovakia now amounts to some 2,000 people. Pope Francis said, "Let us unite in condemning all violence and every form of anti-Semitism." An open-air mass in the Slovak town of Saštin Wednesday caps the pontiff's visit before his return to Rome. The visit to Hungary and Slovakia is his first foreign trip since the Pope underwent colon surgery in July. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
A British woman who ran away from home at age 15 to join the Islamic State group in Syria has asked for forgiveness and appealed to Prime Minister Boris Johnson to let her come home. Shamima Begum was one of three East London schoolgirls who traveled to Syria in 2015. She is now 22 and living in a refugee camp in Syria. Begum has sought to return home, but the British government revoked her citizenship on national security grounds. She told broadcaster ITV that, quote, "I regret every decision I've made since I stepped into Syria, and I will live with it for the rest of my life," unquote. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit vonews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis, moderator for Issues in the News. Join me and a panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken appearing before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee faced tough questioning from lawmakers over last month's withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan. Listen to Issues in the News.